So, in the spirit of how we open this panel, what we're hoping for now is to be able to have some comments and questions for the panelists and get into a real discussion about addressing the issues of racism and white supremacy as they exist in the world and how they are impacting the peace and justice movement, in the spirit of really helping to build and develop the broadest possible movement of opposition to U.S. imperialism and to develop a multiracial, anti-racist project for the long haul and the long term. So with that, I open up the floor. If folks can just raise their hands and introduce themselves when they stand up, and then start off with questions, I suppose, questions or comments. Sister right here in the back. And can you please identify yourself and begin?
My name is Nanda. Is this going to be transcribed onto anything?
Can I hear you?
Is this going to be transcribed? Like, will this be accessible on paper or email or anything?
Yeah, there's a recording that can be gotten from the Brecht Forum, and it's also, I believe, being taped for WBAI.
Oh, great. And my other question was for Asif. Is that your name?
Can you repeat the question, please?
I haven't asked it yet. Could you please talk about the tangible ways that you wanted to suggest to us that people can support your movement?
Oh, by the way, I'm looking for an apartment. This is like that. Please see me. I'm serious. I've been looking for 8 months now, and it's been hard. And I need to leave where I am in a couple of days. Three groups has three areas. A lot of things that were proposed at the UFPJ conference in Chicago 2 weeks ago were in that proposal that I've given and submitted to the War Resisters League 2 years ago. Structural things, you know, quotas and so on. Roots has three working program areas: a workshop area, which would include doing training for trainers, and that's one of the things that's really important about what we're trying to do and what I'm trying to do with the position I have is program work is inherently flawed in that it almost undermines grassroots organizing unless you have a staff to support that. So one of the things that happens over time is that we become experts or technocrats in terms of the specialized skills we have. And that's really dangerous. So one of the things we're trying to do is build and share skills by doing training for trainers and regional mini conferences. And in terms of there's a couple of other areas like resources. We have a resource committee, and that's another program area. That means making everything from headbands to T-shirts to literature and so on. And we're doing kind of recruitment tables. The other thing that we're focusing on right now is doing a seeds program, grant seeds program, and that came out of some meetings I had with some youth of color-led organizations from the Bay Area, and what the idea behind that is that young people in the hood already know what they're experiencing. You know, they don't necessarily need to be dictated to and be told what kind of activism they should get involved in. What they need is resources and money. So the Roots Seeds program would work with youth of color-led organizations to offer, for those organizations who are already in those communities, to offer grants to people in those, young people in those communities to do kind of recruitment work. So we need money for that. That could be, again, anything from them producing their own AOL magazine or whatever it is, them putting on their concerts, them doing a break-in show, however they see counter-recruitment activism as legitimate. So, again, that area could be applied to several other types of program areas. Our focus is military recruitment, but that could be applied to a whole range of issues. And, again, that's taking into account how resources can be shared. And, that really does come down to money and making that money available.
The Carlito in the back, then brother here, sister here.
Yeah, my name is Carlito. I'm with the Vieques Support Campaign. I come from the real West Side Story. Okay. I appreciated the presentations that that I did here. I was busy working. I failed to hear any analysis on the historical socioeconomic roots of racism. I failed to hear how was it that African-American chattel slavery became the premise of racist ideology. There's a reason why I'm throwing that out. I'm uncomfortable with, quote, racism in the movement, unquote. The reason why is because the proclamations made by the anti-war movement are instinctively anti-racist. Anything that is anti-war, anti-imperialist, is anti-racist. You see? And we have to you know, be clear as to who warrants the label racist. We have to be very, very clear and be like a sharpshooter when we throw that one out. Okay? The right wing, the fascists, and the state. Okay? Not my white brothers and sisters next to me who are a bunch of idiots for being insensitive and forgetting their social privilege. Okay? We have to make those distinctions. Okay? And the reason why I say that is because we have to draw the lessons from the past. No one in history has yet topped the authority on this than the Black Panther Party at one time. The Black Panther Party worked with everybody, including white folks. Okay? In fact, they encouraged white people to organize and projected an eventual forging of all the people's movements in this country. And by the way, that's 2 weeks after the Black Panther Party announced that. That's when Fred Hampton was iced.
That's right.
Okay? That's when Fred Hampton was iced. Okay, so let's be clear. Let's be clear, because in our criticism of the remnants of the ideological remnants of this society in our movement, the way we project that, the way we present that criticism, we may wind up shooting our own selves in the foot and alienating and not educating our bright white brothers and sisters as to the significance of racism and the significance of eradicating it.
Thank you for that comment. And that's actually something that was raised by many folks in response to the letter, that the issue of the historical rootedness that you raised, Carlito. And so, but perhaps there are some different response that folks want to actually address that issue up here on the panel. So,
yeah. I disagree with Carlito, my friend. But I disagree with the way he structured what we attempt to present here. First, we did not attempt to do an historical analysis of slavery, which would take a weekend, so to speak, on it. Or we did not attempt to give a clear definition of racism in any type of systemic way, ideologically, structurally. I think what we tried to do, and we, yes, give a broad scope of the contradiction that presents itself to movement, where racism as an integral part of the society and every capitalist society affect not only people who are racist because they're only the ideology of opposition could be in a different political spectrum from us, but even those who within our front. And I think that if we deny that, then we wouldn't explain the complexities of the different movements that have developed historically in this country. Not only in this country, but throughout the anti-colonial process. From Latin America, where you are also from, who explains what's happening in Nicaragua on the Atlantic coast? Who explains what happened when the Colombian left and the issue of the Afro-Colombians. Struggle where some of us come from. We have always have to struggle and those two front constantly. I don't think that to try to address those issues makes it an attack on your white ally. Opposite. I think we raise questions where we have to get consciousness of what building movement and creating solidarity means. Because the same issue happened with the gender question and the sex question. In Latin America, the issue of leadership and the absence of women when the leadership in El Frente and the leadership in various movements. And we cannot say because that was presented that it was against or the people who were critical of the lack of address to those questions becomes enemies or it foster war among them. I think opposite. I think it creates the necessity of movement to understand that we inherit part of the society that we come from, and transformative politics is understanding those contradictions. I was saying to you that when we built the Black Radical Congress in 1998, one of the things we put on the table that we were trying to build a movement that went beyond the Black Panthers Party, a movement that understood what it means to be homophobic. That you could be radical and call yourself a nationalist and want to liberate people, but discriminated people, gay and lesbian, and or your own community. We raised the question of sexism in our movement. We addressed those questions because we wanted to build a new type of movement, including we raised the question of not having an essential Black identity as only defined in the United States, but understanding the diaspora and different aspects of that Black rainbow. So we all are learning that it's broader and that it's sometimes more complex, and oppression comes with many forms of ways things meet together, fusion together. And that if we don't understand that complexity, we could reproduce oppression and silence of voices, even among our own fronts. So I think that's where we're coming from, and not just labeling racism in abstraction.
Okay. What I'd like to do now is, if folks can folks raise their, who want to speak, who have some comments, raise their hands. Okay. I think we can take these. Let's go with Eric, then the sister in the front, and then we'll take your comment. Those three comments, and then if we can have if three comments or questions, and then if there wants to be some response based on that, and then we can move to the next set of questions or comments.
So just three quick points. First one is that I think it's really important, this letter and what went out. It's important to address some issues of racism as they exist in the different, you know, united fronts, popular fronts of the left, particularly around the war. And I think that's one strategy to address the racism at that level. That's one anti-racist strategy. There's another anti-racist strategy which is just as important, if not more important, that I want to address, that I don't think is really addressed in this letter, which is how do we actually build the capacity of people of color on the ground to do anti-war organizing? Because if you don't have a base that's active and supported in communities of color, then four of us, five of us at UFPJ saying you're being racist really doesn't mean that much. Who's behind you? And how do you support them and bring them up and elevate their issues? And I think like that's a real question for me, because if 80% of the African-American community or Latino community does object to the war or think the war is problematic, why isn't there that much activity in those communities? It's not because they don't know how to pull it together. It's because they're under-resourced. But you know what? There are a lot of activities happening in those communities. The Mexican community pulled out a huge number of people for a teach-in in a huge forum in El Barrio around the war. We had a whole bunch of people in Bushwick who went after the ROTC, and there were, it was led by young women of color. But why are they not here tonight? Not because they don't care about these issues, but because they're organizing meetings and doing very important things in their communities. And that's why there's not that many sisters up on the panel, and we got to be honest about that, you know? I mean, there's a lot of brothers up there, and I know that all the people I've been working with on the ground who've been organizing stuff are women of color, and that disparity has to be addressed. So I want to address the second issue around an anti-racist strategy that's about building local communities' capacity to engage in anti-war work that they are ready to do, poised to do. And how do we prioritize that in relationship to being here and talking
about racism within the movement with white people and educating white people. What's the balance? And that's my question. What's the priority today, right now, here?
Thanks. Before we address that, we're just going to take two more comments and questions, and then, so yes, you're in front.
Hi, I'm Nora Roberts. I've been a socialist in this town 30, 40 years now and then, as my singer friend puts it. What I'm aware of is that this situation is racist from the start. Namely, Bush and the imperialists have made of people of color almost equivalent with terrorists. And therefore, it is incumbent on us to view the racial question as an attempt to divide. We cannot say as white people or supporters of the movement, I'm not a terrorist, I'm white. We can't let that happen. And I think the whole issue of are people of color more likely to be terrorists is involved here. And we have to somehow unite around, this time, not letting the racial question divide us.
There was one, there was a hand in the back, brother with the hat. Did you have a question or a comment?
Yeah, I did. I didn't want to cut off the third person.
Okay. He's seated his time on the floor.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Whoever it was. So I'm Nick Patty. Let's see. I'm with the IWW CCDS, which is CFC, and those are listed for identification purposes only. And I'm also with an AFL union, so I'm a dual Carter. Now, I'm also a European American, and I'm racist, which is a terrible thing to say and a terrible thing to admit, but I find it actually very useful in several ways. One is to try to find out how to unlearn the racism that I've been steeped in through various institutions in our society from birth to this day, for instance, public school, high school. We won't go on. Let's see. And also, when I've encountered other white people or people considered white who I think are exhibiting more explicit forms of racism than myself, shall I say, and when I say racism and they say, no, I'm not racist, when I admit that I too am racist, it almost takes their guard down, and it's not like me saying they're evil or something, and then I'm somehow not. Anyway, that was one point. The other point is that I think it's impossible to be absolutely nonviolent in this world today. If you accept the protection of the police, you are not absolutely nonviolent. If you work, you must accept some protection from the police as a result of the boss. Now, that said, I think the personal is political. The political is personal. We have to have an honest discussion about how to become more nonviolent in our personal lives and in our political lives. Thank you.
Thank you. So I just want to ask the panelists who are up here if there's anybody who would like to respond to the question related to the issue of actual base building and resources among communities of color. Anybody want?
So just to respond to the point that Eric raised, and I think that this is a forum to discuss interrelationship, and when you are working in multiracial formations, how you work together, what are some of the issues that come up, and how we experience them and try to deal with them. But I wouldn't formulate those as competing strategies. The strategy of building primarily in communities of color, trying to focus resources there, build there, with an alliance strategy, a multiracial alliance strategy simultaneously. I don't think you think that either from our discussions, right? I think it's a challenging thing to find the work of building in communities requires so much time, it's a difficult, long process. How do people have the time and resources to also work in multiracial formations? It's a difficult thing. And so even if say, for instance, UFBJ's politics is getting better on race and on the war at home, that there's, you know, this greater trust being developed between the more traditional sectors of the peace movement and the immigrant rights movement at some levels, I think that could lead to a broader multiracial coalition, which would be a positive step. But at the same time, the reality is it's also difficult to find time to do both strands, both pieces of the work. So my sense is, some people, I mean, if we can find people who can do both, great. But some people probably should work in one area and some in others. Or, you know, we try to do as best we can. There's got to be a certain division of labor. So I think that the resources should go towards building groups and networks like Racial Justice 9/11 or Black Solidarity Against the War and many other forces on the ground. But at the same time, there's got to be some relationship. The reality is that that's what's necessary to have the power that we need to be able to impact policy. That's the only way I look at it, is what do we need to actually have the power to influence politics to scale, to actually roll back the right-wing initiatives, the right-wing legislation, policies, and so on. So that's the way I look at it.
I think, do you want to just...
Basically, I agree. I think the polls, I think there's not one versus the other. And I think that we are forced, as the reality in this country continues to change, if we were only concentrate in organizing our sector, or we play leadership also in what a movement that affects us is going to do. Because if the movement is left alone and we are not there, I think most of the people who are involved in the UFBJ have a social base. I don't think nobody can question that the Palestinians have a social base to defend themselves here, that the Black Radical Congress, that some of the Latin organizations have participated in the UFBJ. Black Voices for Peace, there's a black movement, a new coalition form of Black Solidarity. Most of those people have a social base. The question remains constantly when you have, I think it was Walter Randle from, an intellectual from Guyana, an activist, who said once that the history of people from African descent, that we never can free ourselves without transforming the society around us. If we free ourselves from slavery, it changes the relationship of power, of economic and social in the society we live in. We are forced to always function on those two parallel levels. How you prioritize and when you prioritize, where you put most of your energy is dependent on historical conjuncture. And groups move forward, move forward and shift according to where they politically they identify strategic at a given moment. So I don't see it for me as one versus the other. I also think that, I want to say one more thing, that there's a tendency, and I, you know, some of us participate in a lot of these discussions, not only here, but around the world, that the discussion about when we raise issues of form of oppression, you normally don't always present the most comprehensive. Not everybody issues, not all sectors, and we have to be careful that we don't do what, for me, the white left has done to the black movement, who bring reparation to this issue, who bring incarceration, that you get accused of being representation politics because it doesn't come in their package and in their language and in their form. I think that the criticism that was made is an attempt, an initial attempt, to raise the issue. I think it's going to get deeper. I think there's a lot of other perspective when it comes into it, and I don't think that this group will get their initial letter having the monopoly or the most comprehensive analysis of what's happening in the peace movement.
Sure, you want to.
Yeah, I wanted to also speak to what Eric was raising, which I think one of the things that's really important at this point is to begin building alliances across and between communities of color. And I think one of the ways that racism functions in the movement is also about invisibility. So there are a lot of ways that Arab Americans or Palestinian Americans become invisible in who gets counted as people of color, who gets counted as being up here. And I think that those are really painful discussions to have but really necessary work to begin as soon as possible.
Okay, so I'm going to do the same thing again. I'm going to call on a couple hands. So John in the back, and then there's the brother in the black shirt back there, and then Steve over there.
I've had my hand up.
So if we can take those three comments, and then we'll come on this side of the room again.
Hi, my name is John Kim. I work with Uptown Youth for Peace and Justice. I do, at this point, mostly support work, but I've been developing relationships with them for the last several years. In the past, I've worked both, for over 15 years in this city, I have worked both with multiracial formations and all people of color organizations, and I just want to make that clear. In my experience, I have always found that the working in multiracial organizations always advances, in my opinion, a strategic goal for a new society. You know, I mean, that's the formation that I've believed, having worked in both. And what I'm wary of, okay, and everything, you know, I really respect what everyone here has said. I'm pretty sure I could add more, you know, onto my experiences with white racism, whether they come from my comrades or whether they come from, you know, like from Bush. And I'm not equating those racisms in the same way. I think they're qualitatively different, you know. But when my comrade says something racist, I tell him, yo, you're racist. And he tells me he wants to punch me out. And I'm like, yo, that's racist, you know. I mean, just chill with that. But but you also have to understand that that type of racism is something very different than the type and the scale of racism that people like Bush are perpetrating at this current moment. So I want to make that clear. Now, the other thing that I'm also worried about is how what I see as a community of people of color activists are coming from. I'm worried about their knee-jerk reactionism to the racism that has been persistent within the white left for quite some time. You know, and I worry about that because I've been living in the city for X amount of years, and every single dilemma that comes up, every single, you know, a juncture of critical importance, you know, like some like emergency crisis that comes up, the same thing happens over and over again. Mm-hmm. And I can't say that I haven't been a part of that problem, that very same problem of racial essentialism, okay? And just like we criticize class essentialism, I think we also have to be wary, dialectically, of racial essentialism. And I say this because Uptown Youth for, you know, Peace and Justice, you know, like Eric was asking, where are the people from Harlem? Uptown, you know, Youth and Peace and, Uptown Youth for Peace and Justice pulled out like over 100 Black and Latino kids from Harlem. Okay. Now, mind you, the main leaders of that movement are from the YCL, the Young Communist League. And yes, the YCL is a part of the CPUSA. And yes, there are white people who are heading it up, and you know, we all understand that. But the complexity of any organization is such that there are young people of color who are trying to transform that organization, who are trying to steer it in the most principled manner possible, fighting racism within those organizations, and so on and so forth. And yet, when they get no, you know, support from other organizations, especially from people of color organizations, okay, and that are just, you know, labeled, you guys are being led by white people, you know, straight up. You know, that's just mad, you know, I don't know, you know how that makes me feel. It's like, you know, you're getting, you know, jabbed on one side, you're getting jabbed from the other. But I just wanted to kind of put that out because I think the record has to be very clear that on the one hand, there may be white racism, there is, you know. But on the other hand, I do believe that in order for the movement to progress in the city, that people of color politics has to expand. It has to move forward. And I just wanted to put that out. That's been kind of, I've been, you know, that's been penned up for like months right now. Thank you. Woo!
So, in the black shirt in the back.
Yeah, this is Amuntu Masemela, longstanding activist in New York. Former member of the Black Radical Congress, Black Panther Party, National Black Independent Political Party, African People's Party, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, my brother Carlito raised up some interesting stuff. I don't think we're going to have the capacity to delve into the detail that it needs to be dealt with. And this, even when you raise up issues of racism within the left, I think that you have to understand that it's so fundamental. and inextricably linked to, in fact, racism in the U.S. and the whole racist paradigm, which is structural racism and its institutional expression, white supremacy. You know, I like to say that there may be about 40% of the white or Euro-American population in the U.S. who are not racist at all, who don't exhibit any racist tendencies or practices. But I think that 99.9% of the Euro-American or white American base are white supremacists, essentially, objectively white supremacists, and that they live in a white supremacist environment that we used to characterize in many different ways, the oppressor nation versus the oppressed nation. We used to talk about within the left white chauvinism versus white racism. I mean, we should talk about the material base for racism and what constitutes the material base for racism. Merle talked about how a white person can go get an apartment, a member of the Young Communist League, white, can go get an apartment where I can't, or some young black youth, activist, radical, can't. And that's an objective basis of racism that this society represents. And your manifestation in it, your the way you carry yourself in this milieu is essentially white supremacists. You don't fight. You don't go out in the street and fight to build a citywide housing movement that makes housing exploitation and racism non-existent in this society. We was at a demonstration for the sister Spruell and the brother Zongo, who were killed by police a couple of weeks ago, a week or so ago, and it virtually was all black and people of color. I mean, so what is that? I mean, how long have we had, demonstration after demonstration in this city for police brutality of essentially murdering black people and Latino people, most of whom are young people, and 90% of the demonstration was from our community, and white people never showed up. It's only recently that we've seen a phenomenon where white people come to demonstrations against police brutality in this city. Okay, so when you talk about racism, you have to look at it within that historical context. Yes, you have to characterize racism coming from slavery. You have to deal with racism. You have to talk about the material base for U.S. imperialism, which was slavery and the exploitation of indigenous people in this country. Okay, those two things essentially carried out the creation of the U.S. imperialist state. The U.S. imperialist state was created before they went anywhere outside of the borders of the United States. You see, by the expropriation of indigenous land, you see, and the enslavement of African people, you had an imperialist state, a domestic imperialist state. Okay, what is it when you have all of these so-called white radicals today who talk about empire? What was going on for the last 100 years in Latin America if it wasn't empire?
That's right.
What was that? Intervention after intervention after intervention after intervention by U.S. imperialism in Latin America. What was that? That was empire. All of a sudden now we hear because a few white people who wrote a few books, what I like to call, this new extension of dilettantism, radical dilettantism, all of a sudden they become, the new left celebrities, the new revolutionaries. I like to hark back to the time when we followed, I don't give a shit whether it was in an orthodox fashion, a dogmatic fashion, but at least we followed black revolutionaries, red revolutionaries, yellow revolutionaries, you see, Latino revolutionaries who built real movements in their country for national liberation, social justice, as opposed to these book writers and pseudo celebrities. Let's deal with that.
We'll take Steve Bloom's comment, then I'll open it up to the panel, and then we'll probably take one or two more questions or comments to wrap it up. So, Steve.
I'm Steve Bloom. I'm one of the signers of the open letter. I'm a member of the socialist organization Solidarity. I'm active with United for Peace and Justice and with the New York Free Mumia Coalition, none of which take any responsibility whatsoever for what I'm about to say. There's an illustration I like to use when we discuss this because it has nothing to do with race. And for that reason, I think people can understand it fairly easily. My mom raised my consciousness on an issue like this when I was a teenager. She talked about my father as the kind of man in the Communist Party who would sit on a stool in the kitchen reading Lenin on the Women Question to their wives while their wives were down scrubbing the kitchen floor. Now, this makes the distinction between our intellectual understandings of issues and our actions,
exactly,
which do not necessarily connect with each other. The radical left always had a good intellectual position on the equality of women. It took an earthquake in social relations due to the rise of the feminist movement in the 1970s to actually change the behaviors of men in the movement, to pick us up, slap us across the face, and, you know, we learned some things. I think we need the same kind of earthquake within the radical left on questions of racial relations. And it's got to come from the same source. People have to be active and pick folks up and give them a good slap across the face. And the things we have to pay attention to this consciously, if we don't pay attention to it consciously, we revert to the behaviors that we learned, that we're comfortable with. We're comfortable with them. We think they're universal because they were universal when we grew up. It was universal. The men did the speaking, the thinking, the writing. The women took care of the kids and prepared the food for the social events. That's not necessarily the fact that we've grown up with it, we're comfortable with it. It's not necessarily the way things should be. I think we can all see that in terms of the relations of men and women. So we've got the same problem in the movement. Whether we call it racism depends on how you define racism. If we're talking about racist intent, I don't think there's anyone on the left in the anti-war movement who is intentionally and consciously racist. Well, maybe there's some,
bullshit.
But not very many.
That's bullshit.
Well, all right, maybe. You can convince me, won't you?
It's a lie.
All right.
It's a lie.
Okay. So maybe there's some. But there's a bigger, much bigger problem. If that's a problem, it's a relatively small problem compared to the problem of behaviors that reflect the racist culture of the society. And if that's what we're talking about racism, then it's fair to talk about racism in the movement or the expressions or manifestations of racism in the movement. So, all right, I'll leave it there.
So, is this... Liz, I see it now. Oh, wait, hold on. I'm sorry. There's this gentleman's been raising his hand. I'm aware of that. So can are there more we don't have that much time. We're wrapping up.
I've had my hand up since the beginning.
Okay. So just one second. So we can take your question, and then we'll take the gentleman's question over here, and then I'm gonna ask. I know that folks have probably more questions, but because it is getting late, we've been here for 2 hours and it is warm. I don't want to say that we can't. What I encourage folks to do is continue the conversation informally as we wrap it up. So take your question and then your question.
Okay, my name's Tom Pauper, and I guess I'm kind of a fixture here. I've been coming here for 16 to 17 years in three different locations. And I want to say, what's your name in Palestine?
Shireen.
What?
Shireen.
Shireen. Well, I don't agree with what you said about the Middle East, but I'm not here to debate you. You know, this is a free country, and as the song says, we disagree.
Yes.
I disagree with you, and you disagree with me. That's not the point of my asking this question. And this is the question I want to raise. I'm concerned that the anti-war movement is all too often driving people away that would normally be very sympathetic to it, if not necessarily radicals, liberals and progressives, by extreme rhetoric and by certain of its actions. I'm concerned especially about driving some of the Jewish population away. You're talking about a group of people. I'm talking about the Jewish population of America and as far as I know of the world also, who's been up front in every social movement that one can think of, and is probably the most if not necessarily radical, the most liberal and progressive white group that one has in this country and perhaps the world. and by actions such as the exclusion. Excuse me, now I'm speaking, I have the floor. And I have the floor, sir. Sir, I have the floor.
Go ahead, go ahead.
And I'm concerned that by the actions such as the, by not allowing Mike Lerner of TCon Magazine to speak at a San Francisco Answer conference, if only in the impression it gives, even though it might have been like strategic or tactical and not an ideological decision, and an extreme rhetoric, anti-Israel rhetoric, which may cross the line from anti-Zionism to not anti-Semitism, I'm concerned that you're driving the Jewish population away. Just one more thing, and then I promise I'll finish. It would be so good if you could get people in public life, not only people like Michael Lerner, but people, let's say, in Congress, like Barney Frank, Sherry Nadler, and Jan Schakowsky, a congressman from Illinois, all of whom were anti-war, at least before the declaration of war. It would be so good if you could get people like that to come to meetings, come to public meetings, and say, well, I am anti-Sharon, I'm pro-Israel, but I'm anti-Sharon, but I'm against this war. Okay. It'd be so good if you could get people to do that and not drive them away with gratuitous rhetoric and actions of the expulsion of Michael Lerner from the Answer Conference.
Thank you. I know that there are folks who want to respond directly to that, so Shireen and Laurel.
Well, I'm really glad you brought up the issue of Jewish activism in the left. I think there's a really great article today by a Jewish activist named Rachel Carmel that actually Hanny forwarded me this morning. You can find it on the website of End the Occupation, and it directly speaks to the role of Jewish Americans and Israelis on the left who have actually been an essential part of the Palestine Solidarity Movement, who have been an essential part of calling against the occupation, of calling against basically the imprisonment of 3 million people who have no basic human rights, who live under occupation, who have lived under occupation for 36 years. It is essential for Jewish activists in this country who identify on the left to call for an end to the occupation.
And
if you look at this article, which I urge all of us to look at, this activist Rachel Carmel says very clearly, if Israel is about it being a safe haven for Jewish people, it will never be safe as long as it occupies 3 million people. It will never be safe. And, you know, safety for Jewish Americans or Israelis is also not going to come out of an alliance with United States imperialism.
Yeah, I completely agree with that, and I want to add a couple of things. I come out of the Jewish community. My family's Jewish. I'm not particularly religious, but I do think there's a history, a certain tradition in the Jewish community of struggling for justice and peace. And I don't think we can be true to that experience without supporting the rights of the Palestinian people and calling for an end to the occupation. Any Jewish tradition that I come out of, it, you know, would be violated by not calling for that. That's the first thing. The second thing is I think that people have talked about the sort of level of unity of the anti-war movement and anti-occupation, and support for equality for everybody. But I also want to say personally, I'm also anti-Zionist. And I don't think there's anything incompatible with being Jewish and being anti-Zionist. Because a lot of us don't believe in the idea of an exclusive religious state for any religion. And as Jews, it's kind of repugnant to me to say there should be a state where people who happen to be with the Jewish religion get rights and other people don't. Especially that it gets racialized and stuff. But there's a whole history of... The other thing is there's a long history in the Jewish movement of how the Zionist movement came. It came from a certain class perspective. It came from a certain way of looking at fighting anti-Semitism. Do you fight it or do you run and take someone else's land? It had to do with support from upper class elements. I mean, it's a long story, I don't want to debate it either, but I think that's very consistent with the progressive tradition which you identified, and there are others as well. It's not the only one in Jewish group, but that tradition to be anti-Zionist as well as being anti-occupation. And I think that this is a discussion that has to happen more in the movement. Because either you stand for justice or you don't, and I think so. I won't go on, but I think it's important to say that.
So,
I'm gonna ask two more hands, and then I'm gonna give an opportunity to the panelists to. So first we'll take Liz and this gentleman who we took first, and then Liz in the back, and then panelists, if you want to make some closing comments. I just asked folks to try to keep these comments as brief as possible so that we can move into the informal section of the discussion when we can just mingle.
My name is Padiaway. I'm from Africa. Still an enslaved continent, also mistakenly called the third world, as if there's a first world. I mean, when I look at the world and the world that has been created actually by Europeans who mistakenly call themselves white, there is no white race. I will call it a pale race, if there is anything. And I think, we always talk about the economic factor of slavery and so on, but when we look at the world, even the intellectual, there's intellectual white supremacy. And almost every section of all the social movements have been inundated by that in their criticisms, in their analysis. For instance, when Karl Marx was doing all his, ramble around the world trying to, for his dialectical materialism, what he found was that he was unable to analyze Africa because African societies did not fit into his model of feudal, the Hegelian dialecticism of thesis, antithesis, and the synthesis. Africa did not fit into that because most of the societies did not have feudal systems. The land was still owned by the people. And I can give an example from my own society. The land was owned by me, by everybody. So when Europeans or Americans analyze the societies in terms of socialism, what they try to do is they just forget that what they are trying to do is actually intellectual imperialism. And what one finds in most of these write-ups about criticisms of the war, of Bush, of everything, it is just purely white supremacy, because what they're trying to write is nothing else but what they've studied in white schools, whether it is sociology, whether it is psychology, all of it comes into play. And for me, when I read it, I always laugh. I say, look at, these guys are saying they are not racist, they are not white supremacists, but what comes out of it? Whether they are socialist, whether they are Marxist, what comes out is that pure racism and white supremacy.
Yeah, I'll be very brief. I was a little uncomfortable with Steve's formulation because I feel like there's a very fine line where, on the one hand, yes, white folks who are completely unaware of their privilege in most cases and do need to be slapped around, but my opinion is the slapping around needs to come from other white folks, that the work of white allies who are anti-racist is to do that work. It is not the job of people of color to educate white people, to slap them around and wake them up. It's they're organizing, you guys are organizing your communities, and white folks, we have to organize each other against racism. We have to figure out how to be good allies. We need to consult, and we need to follow the leadership of communities of color, and we are not... we can't sit around and wait to be, slapped around or for that shift in consciousness to somehow reach some critical mass. We have to be doing that work ourselves. That's the work of white anti-racist people. Sorry?
Slap white folks around.
And again, it's metaphor, and I also would like to third some of these voices. I work with Jews Against the Occupation, and I feel like absolutely we cannot slip into the collapsing of what Zionism and Judaism mean, because the work of
people who do resonate, and I don't resonate with the Jewish religion, but for people who do, it's within, you know, that the tenets of that particular spirituality and religion to work for justice and to work for a peaceful place where all people can live. And so we need to really be particular and careful about, you know, addressing Zionism and the violence of Zionism.
Very good. Getting late, y'all. It's almost 10 o'clock, so I want to just give a quick opportunity, a very brief opportunity, if I may have the floor, for the panelists, if anybody has any closing remarks, and then we'll close it out.
I was just wondering, is there anybody in this room who doesn't identify with being anti-racist? Okay, so this is probably not, you know, like where the struggle of us really trying to convince each other of something should be. I'm sure, like, you know, that engagement needs to happen. Everything that transpired here was important. But the real work is just going back to your communities, to your organizations, and really taking this on work in a, you know, in a real structural and serious manner. It's, again, like the War Resisters League is pretty heavily impacted, but that does, the reason why I've been there for 4 years is I do believe in change and it's possible and transformation. We do need support, active support from you know, people here, from people who you guys have contacts with. So, you know, again, we're not really necessarily having to convince anybody here of anything different. It's just really going out on the streets, going into your communities, going into your organizations and taking action. You know, we could always talk and build in more informal settings, but, you know, let's try to make this happen, Pete.
I think that the issue of racism, why it's so complex, is that it's not something that you label. It's not a label. And it's a practice at the end. And I work in healthcare, for example, and even good intention, you still have health disparity. Tremendous health disparity. People are diagnosed the same, and the same doctor give them different treatment with good intention. That doctor doesn't believe they're racist. I think it's something deeper that that we need to start asking ourselves a question: how normal racism has become in this society? Should become invisible? And if that's not true, even though the people in the room, like the brother just mentioned, every time we would have an event and a rally, by some incident or accident, the press conferences are planned and we are not included. Somehow, when we plan certain events, our view were left out. And it happens still. And you ask yourself if the people who are doing that intentionally are racist. So I think we have to move away from the issue of that, if it's intentional or not. At the end, it's looking at the practice, looking at the result. And I want to end saying something that I think this affirmative action ruling just opened a major debate in this country. Because some people are seeing that the issue of the struggle against racism in this country is a matter of diversity. Diversity is a result of the process in the struggle against racism. It is about changing the relationship of power. It's about changing the way we have used race systemically and in very complex form to deprive people of their rights. So I think affirmative action, we don't fall in the trap about if you're diverse, you're equal. If you're diverse, we address the problem. Diversity is an outcome. We need to look at the issue of race relation in the same sense we look at all the intricate relationship about power and who makes decision and whose life it affects at the end, and explain why after 100 years you still have 40 years of affirmative action, you still have the disparity that exists in the society. It's still a question for the movement to answer. And I will end saying also that I think the brother Muntu raised this earlier, that the issue a lot of the movement people to talk about being critical, and when you have problem where you have a government that invade and occupy other people, and you don't raise a question of imperialism, you don't raise a question of occupation in Palestine, invasion of Panama, the threat against Cuba, the intervention in various ways, you also support a policy that is race-defined, because you don't invade Europe, you don't massacre certain people, and you must ask yourself why those questions are there. So we need to start looking at these things if we want to build a movement that has the capacity to make change at home and abroad. Thank you.
That in the end, anti-racism doesn't just mean that we're all committed to anti-racism in this room. Anti-racism in the end is going to mean that what this room will look like is different. Who's going to have power to speak, whether it's up here or, you know, in the crowd, is going to be different. People are going to have to give up their sense of entitlement and the access they have to positions and power, and that's, you know, what has to happen.
Yeah, I agree with that, because I think it's not just saying that you're not a racist or we're anti-racist. It's a question of what you do about it. You know, I think people, radicals and revolutionaries, are talking about a redistribution of power in the world. You know, and if this is like a fundamental error for redistribution of power. If we don't stand for it here, we can't say we stand for it in any other sector. I think that's the first thing. The other thing is, when we go out of it, I think that Asif was saying is go to your own organization. People here and the people in the audience can speak. There's resources available. But put this on the agenda to have a serious discussion. What does this mean for your political work, your organization, your community work, your sector? And I think if it's raised that way, where every organization in the city or in the country is having a discussion, what does it mean to me to promote true anti-racism, to fight white supremacy, to have true equality and respect and power sharing? Then the dynamics will change. Then you won't see the next peace conference and the press conference and the peace movement with white folks talking only. So I think that's what it's really about, is going and having a struggle, never being complacent and saying, oh, I dealt with that. Because none of us, you know, we haven't dealt with that. We're not going to deal with it except through struggle. So I want to encourage people to organize meetings in your own organization. Ask people here and some of the people in the audience who've spoken to come and speak if you need that. Do anti-racist training, but really take it up and have a plan. So that, and you have goals for the next year, for the next 10 years about this.
Real quickly, going back, I've been thinking more about the question that Eric Tang posed earlier about competing strategies, whether or not they're competing strategies in organizing communities of color and organizing in multiracial fronts, multiracial coalitions. And it occurs to me that if we take up the challenge that people have laid out here, as white folks take up the challenge to be allies and fight racism, one of the things it does is it frees up the time and energy of people of color who may be rooted in other communities to spend time organizing in those communities. Right? If you only knew how many hours I spent, or people from El Auda, working to try to hammer out a decent position on Palestine with some of the folks in the United for Peace and Justice, who were really struggling to try to keep the thing quiet, don't dare talk about U.S. foreign policy, etc. If I had that time to do other work, we would have been in a stronger movement, right? Or and others would have as well. That's part of why the challenge, it's so necessary for allies to take it up. It's why it's so necessary for men to take up the fight against sexism and so on, right? It frees up people's time and energy to build a more powerful organization that is genuinely representative and that has the capacity to influence what happens in this country. So we encourage people, we call upon people here to do as much as possible to take up that fight wherever you are.
On that note, thank you all for coming. Thank you to the Brecht Forum.